This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. The Massachusetts congressional delegation in Washington was largely a thorn in President Obama's side this week. Many of the delegation members loudly opposed the deal the president struck with Republicans to extend Bush-era tax cuts. Everyone in D.C. seems to be in favor of extending tax cuts for middle-class earners. But Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern says in these tough times, extending those cuts to the wealthy doesn't make sense.
Here we are passing a bill that's not paid for, that adds hundreds of millions of dollars to the deficit, that says that if you earn $1 million, you get a $100,000 tax cut. I mean, give me a break.
And our editorial roundtable this week, we're going to talk about how Democratic congressmen from Massachusetts have been leading the intra-party revolt. But first, WBUR's Bob Oakes, host of Morning Edition, joins me now because he spent a couple of days this week in D.C. talking with members of the delegation. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Sasha.
So, Bob, it appeared to many people back here in Boston that several Massachusetts congressmen featured pretty prominently among the Democrats who are upset with President Obama about that tax cut deal. And you talked with some of those upset Democrats. Tell us what they told you.
Well, no question about it, Sasha. We talked with Congressman Markey, the dean of the delegation, Congressman Capuano, Congressman Barney Frank, and Jim McGovern from Worcester. You just heard him. They all see this as pretty much a very straightforward political slash philosophical difference with the White House. They all think that extending the Bush tax cuts to the wealthiest of Americans is a bad idea, sending the wrong message to lower and middle class Americans struggling in this economy. But also, you couldn't simply help but think after you talk to all these people that their collective noses were just out of joint, at least partially, because they weren't consulted as the Democrats negotiated with the Republicans, including the Massachusetts delegation, which will get a chance to weigh in again when this package comes back to the House floor.
So we all know that Massachusetts politicians have a long history of being viewed by other parts of the country as just too liberal for the mainstream. Do you feel like this is another example of that?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. When you listen to the delegation, you hear them say that they believe they're simply representing their constituents. I think it was Congressman Capuano who told us that the phone calls coming into his office in the last few days are running 8-1 against the plan. So from his point of view, in opposing the plan, he's simply representing the will of his constituents. But I should probably also point out that none of them said, I believe, that they'd carry out this fight against tax cuts to the wealthy to the bitter end. They're all hoping the package change. Capuano, in fact, saying, let's see what is in the final package. Let's see what it looks like.
Now, there was some other Massachusetts delegation news this week, and that had to do with Congressman Richard Neal from Springfield. For part of the day yesterday, it looked like he might be elevated to the top minority position on House Ways and Means Committee. That's, of course, a very powerful committee. It deals with any legislation that has to do with taxes. But that didn't come to be. What happened there?
Well, it was a blow to Richie Neal, who's, as we pointed out, from Springfield. He was picked by one vote by the steering committee to be the ranking Democrat on the Ways and Means Committee. But that vote was overturned by the full Democratic caucus, which instead picked 79-year-old Sander Levin of Michigan over Neal. We were in Congressman Capuano's office when word came that Richie Neal lost the big vote. Capuano said he was disappointed, but also shrugged it off, saying that when push comes to shove, Democrats always vote for seniority, and Levin was more senior on Ways and Means than Neal. We tried to find Richie Neal about an hour later. We went right to his office, and we were told by his staffers that right after the vote, Richie Neal got on a plane and left for Springfield.
Hmm. You know, Bob, of course Obama has problems with Republicans, but now there seems to be this split that he has with House Democrats. Is the sense over there that bodes really not very well for next session?
Well, we talked a lot about that with the members of the delegation, whether they'd expect more of these fights with the White House down the road after the next Congress convenes in January. But none of the members of the Massachusetts delegation we spoke with said they thought that this battle over taxes did anything to weaken the president, even though many political commentators think just the opposite. Barney Frank, in fact, said he doesn't think this necessarily characterizes the White House relationship with Democrats going forward.
The tax bill was a special issue. I don't think it portends any ongoing split. I think when the Republicans try to undo the health care bill or undermine the financial regulatory reform, that will cause Democrats to be fairly united in supporting what we've done.
And Bob, the reason you were in D.C. this week is that you're working on a piece that's going to air on Morning Edition that will preview the next Congress and that will talk about the changing role that the Massachusetts delegation will be playing next year. When can listeners expect to hear that?
Well, that piece is probably not going to come for a couple of weeks. We're thinking about running it right when the next Congress starts early in January. But it'll be an interesting piece because they all talked about whether they thought the Massachusetts delegation loses a little pizzazz when it becomes part of the Democratic minority on Capitol Hill as opposed to the majority. And two powerful congressmen, Congressman Markey and Congressman Frank, are losing important committee chairmanships because of this. We're going to speak to Congressman Frank on Monday about the financial services overhaul, which he was talking about, or he was alluding to just a moment ago, him saying that he thinks that this very important piece of legislation that he won after a long, hard fight on Capitol Hill just in the last few months will largely remain intact. It's an interesting conversation, and that conversation can be heard on Morning Edition on Monday.
Bob, thanks for that little update on your D.C. trip this week.
Sure thing, Sasha.
Bob Oakes hosts Morning Edition on WBUR. And joining us now to talk more about the goings-on in Washington, especially among the state's congressional delegation, is Boston Globe editorial page editor Peter Kanellis. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Peter.
Thanks, Sasha.
And former state representative Susan Tracy, who did political analysis for us all throughout the campaign this fall. Welcome back to you too, Susan.
Thanks, Sasha. And hi, Peter.
And listeners, we want to know what story got you talking this week. Were you happy to see Massachusetts Democrats standing up to President Obama's tax cut plan? Are you worried about what this sort of strife between Obama and the Democrats means for this coming term? Do you think that Bush tax cuts ought to be extended for everyone? We're also going to be talking about Scott Brown's nuanced position, you might call it, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. State Street cuts. Any other news of the week you want to talk about? Indicting people for their DNA? Call us if it caught your attention and we can talk about it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Peter Kanellis and Susan Tracy, we just heard Bob Oakes say that when he talked to congressional Democrats in D.C. these past few days, they were very unhappy for the most part with the president's tax deal. We actually have some sound as well from Congressman Jim McGovern, and here he is expressing his disappointment in the president.
I think we should have fought, you know, on behalf of our principles. I wanted the president to fight a little bit more.
So, Susan and Peter, you know, it's interesting. We also heard John Kerry weigh in this week, and he said, look, the reality is we have to deal with reality, and it might seem nice in the hypothetical to not have to compromise, but that he felt that the president had to. And I wonder, both Susan and Peter, what you come away with. I mean, Obama basically said, unless I do this, we're not going to be able to extend unemployment benefits. And I wonder your take on how damaging was that for Obama, considering the upset he now has against him from at least Massachusetts Democrats.
In the long run, I don't think it's damaging. I think you have to put the midterm elections into perspective, both from our delegation's perspective and from the president's. You know, our delegation, we're the only delegation, I think, where everyone incumbent was reelected. We are in a sea of, we're in an island of blue and a sea of red here. And I think for all of the members of the House side, they've all lost their chairmanships. And I think they probably have, I think Bob Oakes said their nose is out of joint a little bit. And I think that's right. I think they feel like we didn't fight hard enough. And now they're not going to go down without a fight. They probably still have a little edge coming off the elections. And they do represent their districts. And, you know, President Obama is not president of Massachusetts. He's president of the country. He doesn't need a high-stakes game of chicken with the Republicans right now. I think everyone's doing what they need to do based upon the position they're in.
And Peter, what do you think? How do the Democrats sort of express their upset with the president but still make sure they have a working relationship with this guy considering the troubles he has with Republicans?
Well, I strongly agree with what Susan just said. I think that Obama is acting in the national interest and is also acting in what will ultimately be in his good political interest, because people really do want to see something productive coming out of Washington. They don't want to see a big stand that's designed to sort of change the political dynamic at the cost of 3 or 4 months of stasis. They just don't have the stomach for it. And so Obama's doing the right thing. I do think that the Democrats, liberal Democrats, are legitimately concerned that President Obama has a natural bent towards compromise. He likes to remain a little bit above the fray, and a lot of them felt like he was and can still be their evangelist taking liberal causes to the country, rallying the public to their side. And he really has not done that as president. And they're concerned that with the Republicans taking over, you know, it's going to be 2 years of compromises rather than showdowns in which they have the better orator and the better forum of the presidency. So I think they're quite worried about that. But at the same time, Obama is doing what he has to do as president.
Peter Kanellis and Susan Tracy, we have a caller from Everett who wants to weigh in on this, and this is Barry. And Barry, your thoughts about this tax deal compromise that extends tax cuts even to the very wealthy?
I'm not in favor of it. The Republicans always seem to be talking about class warfare, and don't do this, that's class warfare. But by taking this stand, they're inviting class warfare, and I think rather than fight a long, slow battle, we should just have it. Let's have it out on this. This is the issue. I think it's a discerning issue.
Barry, do you consider yourself an Obama supporter?
You know what? I used to be. If he won't fight this fight, then the quicker we get rid of him, the quicker the Republicans will have their turn, and the quicker we can get somebody else in there. And I can't... I'm a person who's never voted anything but Democrat in my life. And I thought if Hollywood scripted a person to be president, well, Barack Obama was the guy. And he really disappointed me.
So in particular, did this compromise disappoint you? For tax cuts?
I don't think there should be a compromise. I think they should... remember who was that talked about brinkmanship. I dare the Republicans to stick it to the unemployed. I dare them. I dare them to stick it to the middle class, all over the tax cuts for the most wealthy people on earth.
So Barry, you would have been willing to have Obama say, I won't compromise, even if that meant it might have cut off unemployment insurance. You were willing to see if that would actually happen, if it would just be a game of chicken?
I remember in the Bush administration... he secretly moved millions of dollars, well, probably billions of dollars, from Afghanistan to Iraq to fund war that hadn't even started yet. I would do the same. I would pull a financial maneuver and keep paying those people.
Barry, thanks for that. I want to bring in a caller from Holden also. This is Mike calling. And Mike, your thoughts on President Obama and this compromise, this deal that would also extend tax cuts to the wealthy, not just the middle class.
Right. I mean, I'm opposed to it. It seems to me that it's akin to husband and wife. One say wanting to, you know, they've got economic problems. One wants to go on vacation and one wants to buy a boat. So they decide to compromise and do both. It doesn't make any rational sense at all. And it's not a compromise. It's really just both parties getting what they want. And it's not going to serve the nation in the long run at all.
Mike, thank you for that. Before I have Peter Kanellis and Susan Tracy weigh in, we have one more caller. This is a caller from Milton, and this is Lisa. And Lisa, your thoughts about Obama's deal / compromise to cut taxes, not just for the middle class, but for the very wealthy.
Yeah, I can't say I agree with them giving the rich people a break, but I like the fact that he's compromising in general. I like the concept of it, but more particularly, I love the fact that the Democrats are getting spunky. I'm so sick of people saying that they're weak. My father, the diehard Republican, said to me a few months ago, well, you know, they've got all these great ideas, but if they can't stick together, they can't get them through. Well, deal with them. And I think it's wonderful to see them just kind of stand on their ground for once.
So even that you like that the Democrats who didn't agree with Obama are speaking up about that vocally.
Absolutely.
Lisa, thanks for that. Peter and Susan, before we move on to another issue, you want to comment on any of those callers' comments?
I will say, I think there's a kind of crazy logic to these three calls that
I
are
the same
seemingly
reaction.
So different. In that,
yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
in that, you know, people do want to compromise. They do want to compromise. There's also nothing wrong with the Massachusetts delegation and the other liberals standing up for what they believe. And I think that, you know, there is a strong argument against the tax cuts for the rich. But the one thing I don't agree with is I sort of agree that they're kind of combining their two programs and giving each other both, but I think that there is some value to economic stimulus at this point, and this is not an austerity move by any means, but to have another $300 billion next year kind of pumped into the economy is actually going to help a lot in the job market.
Let me move on to another political issue, and that's what I referenced, which is that Richard Neal from Springfield, which who looked like he might end up having the top position, the top minority leader on that very important Ways and Means Committee, is not going to get it. And I wonder, Susan Tracy, if you could comment on what is lost by him not being in that position, or what might have gained for Massachusetts in particular if he had gotten that position.
Well, two things. First of all, this I know that was referenced that the steering committee supported him. Actually, that was not true. I think it was a 23-22 vote. Maxine Waters didn't get back in time to vote, issued a statement immediately saying she would have voted for Levin. So it was a tie vote coming out of committee, first of all. I'm with, I think, what Mike Capuano said, which is, you know, seniority was going to prevail. I think, you know, is it better to have someone from Massachusetts on Ways and Means? Probably. Is it the end of the world? No. And quite honestly, I think Congressman Neal is probably positioned pretty well for the future. Congressman Levin is 79 years old, and I think Neal's probably in a good long-term position.
Peter Cannell, speaking of Levin being 79, that made him more senior. And Congressman Neal, when he didn't get the appointment, had said that that Levin getting it was, quote, a good reminder of how difficult it is to challenge the seniority system in Congress. I wonder if, assuming you had come across that, it sounded to you like sour grapes or criticism or just sort of the reality of what it takes to elevate in that system.
Yeah, I think it's probably the latter. I wonder if the same result would have occurred if they had the majority, because ranking member is something of an honorific, whereas when you're the chairman, there's just a lot of work to do. You have to put together a lot of deals and things. And there was a little bit of a perception that Neal, who is younger and a little more sprightly than Sandra Levin, may have been a stronger chairman than Levin. And so I wonder if some of the Democrats, realizing that as ranking member you're not really carrying as much freight, decided to defer to the seniority argument this time around, but maybe if there were a challenge in the future, it might be open to a different chairman.
Susan Tracy and Peter Cannellis, I both want to have you weigh in on Scott Brown, who had said he would be in support of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but then it was time to vote. He didn't sort of follow through with what he had indicated he would do. Now, he's saying that he was not going to vote on that issue before a tax cut extension package could get through, that needed to be priority. But I wonder your take on that. You know, he had a chance to sort of make good on his pledge to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but then he ended up voting against the repeal. What did the two of you make of that?
To me, he chose politics over civil rights. It's a pretty simple issue, or, you know, off the bat for me. Susan Collins, Republican senator from Maine, did the right thing on that vote, in my opinion. And, you know, I think this is where you really see the difference between voting the right way, because, you know, people can cast a vote the right way, and being someone who's a leader and cares about an issue. And I think what we have is Scott Brown will vote the right way at some point, but he's, you know, going to do it when it politically suits him.
Peter, do you look at it that black and white?
I look at it more as a sign of quirkiness in Scott Brown, and it's part of the still developing picture
like.
That we have of I don't like it either, but it's part of the still developing picture we have of Brown's sort of odd politics here. You know, he's certainly emerging as a maverick figure, and I guess I take him at face value that he wants to repeal this, but he's sticking to his principles in terms of wanting to deal with the tax issue first.
Well, tax issues are more important to him than civil rights issues. That's how I read that.
Peter and Susan, we need to take a brief break, but stay with us, and listeners, stay with us, because we're going to still be talking about the week we come back. We're going to talk about some less political things, including this news that it's now okayed by the state's highest court that you can indict DNA. So if you haven't found the suspect, you can indict the DNA, and then that way you keep the statute of limitations from expiring. We're going to talk about the Shapiro family having to give back some of the money they made from Bernie Madoff. Could that possibly harm philanthropic giving in Boston? Anything else you want to talk about? State Street Bank laying off people while also announcing profits? Call us in about a minute at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Cannellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and former state rep Susan Tracy will be with us when we're back in about a minute. This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and I'm talking with Peter Cannellis. He's the editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, and Susan Tracy, a political analyst and former state rep. They're our Week in Review panelists this week. And Susan and Peter, I want to ask you both about what I thought was a quite interesting story about DNA evidence being indictable, and what that does is if you don't have the suspect, but you do have the suspect's DNA, you can basically prevent the statute of limitations from running out. What I thought was particularly interesting about this is that apparently, at least in Suffolk County, prosecutors have been indicting DNA profiles for the last decade.
Yeah.
And it's just that now this case went to the SJC because they apparently found one of the actual suspects. So there was a real person. And I thought that was quite interesting. Peter, would you weigh in first? Because you went to law school. You're a lawyer, although you've sort of you're a journalist with a law degree, let's say.
It's true.
I'm interested in your thoughts about this.
I'm interested, too, because I found myself this morning trying to puzzle out what is the purpose of the statute of limitations.
Yeah.
I mean, and I wonder, originally originally, I think there probably was a consideration that, that evidence would get cold, and mm-hmm. that at a certain point you want to just sort of say, look, it's too uncertain. And DNA evidence is not uncertain. DNA evidence is absolutely certain. So I think this decision makes sense to me.
In fact, there was a line in the paper by the Suffolk DA, Dan Connolly, who says this decision just, quote, brings Massachusetts up to speed with the field of science that advances every day, right. which I think speaks to what you just said, Peter.
Yes. Right.
Two other things to note on that. It was a unanimous decision, and I believe five other states have already made a similar call. So,
and another issue I wanted to bring up while I have both of you is the Shapiro family, of course, which have been extremely generous donors to Boston for all sorts of charitable reasons, had to give back a $625 million this week that the government claims they earned as investors with Bernie Madoff and don't deserve to have. You know, it sounds like a lot of money to most people, but I wonder, in terms of what the two of you know about the Shapiros, how damaging is that to them, both personally and in terms of their charitable giving?
I don't know what the total wealth of the Shapiros is, but I know that this is potentially, you know, significant and devastating ramifications for them. On the other hand, I think the larger interest is that money that is ill-gotten, even though they had no idea that it was ill-gotten through Bernie Madoff, should be returned. And I know there are a lot of Boston institutions that were rooting for the Shapiros here, but probably this is a just result.
I completely agree. Look, this is a philanthropic family, and a philanthropic family would want to make sure that people who lost everything are also taken care of. And this will help some people who get
so this was basically a so-called clawback. Do either of you think it's possible that then the clawback could reach all the way to places like the MFA or Brandeis or any of the hospitals the Shapiros have given money to?
Yeah, Peter's the lawyer. I'll let him speak to it. But my gut is you're not going to start taking paintings off the walls. And you know.
Well, I haven't heard that there's a legal mechanism for them to take the money back that's already been spent and given. But I do know that the Shapiros had some pledges out, and they had said that, you know, to the best of their ability, they would honor the pledges going forward, and I think they will, but we'll have to see how that plays out in the future.
In the time we have left, and we don't have as much as usual, so I wonder if the two of you can do this more quickly than we usually do, but on Friday we usually talk about what we call our Friday hubbub. That's the one story of the week that really interested you but may have been a bit below the radar. Susan Tracy, was there one that caught your eye?
It's just a category. I feel like it's freezing out. The economy is lousy, and I feel like the best thing that happens in this town is Boston sports. And this week, between the Gonzalez, Crawford, the Tom Brady annihilating the Jets, the Celtics are on fire, and the Bruins are doing great. I feel like it's the ray of hope in our city that makes us all feel good, even when we're freezing.
It's a good Boston hubbub. And Peter, yours?
The plan to make it easier for food trucks to come into the city.
Oh, you know, right.
So many regulations prevent things, but this is also a great opportunity for the immigrant community who man a lot of these trucks and bring them on.
Oh, that's great. I want to mention two things. One is quickly that, you know, there is this wake today for this Sudbury 23-year-old who died in Afghanistan. Every of these deaths is terrible, but this was a UNH grad. He graduated from Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School in 2005. He'd been in Afghanistan 1 month and he died. And Sudbury is planning the wake and the funeral at Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School. It sounds like this thing is going to be very well attended. And then another soldier this week from Massachusetts died in Afghanistan. This was a 25-year-old from Salem, James Ayubi. So the losses in Massachusetts continue. I also want to mention that a Newton man, Lin Chang, he played the violin at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony that happened in Oslo today. This is a sound of him playing. The prize went to a Chinese human rights activist named Li Yu Xiaobao. He couldn't attend because he's in prison in China for opposing communist regime. So several people sat in for him, including this Newton violinist. And here's a little bit of that performance. So that's a Newton man playing in Oslo at the peace ceremony where the Nobel Peace Prize winner could not attend. So Susan Tracy, former state rep and political analyst, and Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, thank you very much for doing our weekend review with us.
Have a nice weekend.
You too.
Thank you, Sasha.
Radio Boston's Adam Ragusea joins me, as he does on many Fridays, to go over your feedback from our shows this week. Hi, Adam.
Hello, Sasha.
So, Adam, back on Monday, we spoke with Northeastern University housing economist Barry Bluestone. Now, Barry, for many years, has been sounding the alarm about all the students who leave Massachusetts after they graduate. And he shared with us a big idea he's been shopping around Boston City Hall.
The idea of a multi-university graduate student village, someplace near transit. What we would also do is not only allow graduate students to live there when they're in school, but give them the right to stay there 3 to 5 years after they graduate.
I love this idea, comments Maria Zaid over at WBUR.org/Boston. I am 26 years old and weighing my options for graduate school, as are many of my friends. The higher cost of attending school in Boston due to rents and the limited housing options offered by many universities versus other cities and states is a significant strike against staying here. Were the city to step in and provide a low-cost alternative, it would reframe the debate for many prospective students.
But not everyone felt that way.
No. So Raj wrote this. The idea seems a bit contrived. Grad student ghettoization is exactly what graduate study is not about and not what a vibrant Boston is about. Neighborhood diversity should be the sustainable goal.
We also had a number of people email us asking what the tax status of this proposed village would be.
Right. So DB wrote, more than 50% of Boston real estate is not taxable, even though wealthy nonprofits are able to build billion-dollar projects. This ever-shrinking tax base is causing Boston to close schools and libraries and cut back on other services. Deadly trend.
Professor Bluestone actually addressed that issue on Monday, but it went by pretty quickly, so let's replay that part.
The universities would not be responsible for owning it or paying for it. They would be responsible for marketing it. But developers, private developers, would put it up. It would remain on the tax rolls.
So there it is. And we should mention that since we aired that segment, we've heard that Bluestone's proposal is getting a lot of interest, both in City Hall and from some big-name developers.
Okay, so feedback on a different story this week. On Tuesday, we talked to Tufts philosophy professor Daniel Dennett. He's doing an ongoing investigation into religious doubt among faith leaders. In other words, clergy members who are closet non-believers.
Nobody doubts that this is a real phenomenon. In all the reactions we've had to our first study, not a single religious leader said, oh, this is a tiny little subset of pastors. I think in some denominations, it may be 80%, you know?
Now, that sparked a vigorous conversation among our listeners at WBUR.org/Boston. But, Adam, what our listeners did not see was an email sent to us by one of the pastors who was actually interviewed as part of Daniel Dennett's initial study.
That's right. And you'll soon understand why he asked us not to identify him by name. Here's what he wrote. Personally, I want to thank the Tufts researchers for their work in discovering this phenomenon and giving the opportunity for others like me to finally share their situation with someone. I cannot begin to express in a brief blurb the desperately complicated situation I am in, with the internal torment of proclaiming what I do not believe, with the responsibility of caring for the financial and emotional needs of my family. I'm trying desperately to find other work but have limited marketable skills. Few can grasp, let alone understand, the complexity of our situation.
And again, that's from a pastor who doubts whether he believes. So finally, on a far less heavy note, on Wednesday, we heard music from the Berklee College of Music's video game music choir, including this arrangement of the theme song from Tetris.
Now, Katya Wish commented online that she thought the music sounded very similar to a Russian folk song called The Moon is Shining Brightly, and she provided a link to that. Now, that does sound very similar, but according to our research, the music derives from another Russian folk song called Korobeniki, which is a word describing a kind of peddler. The song tells the story of a peddler haggling over a price with a young woman, and I get the sense that it's all a romantic allegory.
Oh, Adam, we have such smart cultured listeners.
Oh, we do.
And listeners, keep your feedback coming at WBUR.org/Boston. Radio Boston's Adam Ragusea, thank you for coming in again.
We'll see you Monday.
Coming up after the break, city workers were up late in the night this week working on Charlestown's bike lanes. But they weren't painting new ones. They were scraping the city's very first bike lanes right off the street. We'll talk about bike lane backlash in Boston right after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.